right. The next matter on the court's calendar is A190618 Blank et al. Versus Carter and Ameriprise and EAN Holdings et al. As counsel's aware, each side will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Are counsel for respondents going to split your time?
We are, Your Honor.
And how are you going to do that?
Counsel for EAN is going to go first, and then I'll go second.
All right. Is there an agreement between you as to how much time you're each going to take?
It seems unlikely that we would use the entire 15 minutes unless there is an abundance of questions. I probably will have more than him, but 10 minutes.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you don't want to split your time precisely, it's fine. We'll just count it as 15, but I just want you to understand, if one of you goes longer because of the court's questioning, the other may not have much time.
Okay.
All right?
We'll be fine.
All right, as long as you can work on that, that's fine with the court. And then if you would identify yourselves for us at the beginning of your arguments for the record. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Marcy Wallace. I represent Tom Blank and Linda Bjorklund, the plaintiffs below and the appellants here. Tom Blank was rear-ended by a speeding driver, despite the fact that this state has a strong public policy in favor of compensating victims like Mr. Blank. As matters now stand, the only insurance benefits he will get from that accident are the no-fault benefits that took care of his medical bills. There are a number of reasons for this, and we have raised a number of issues, and it's hard to cover them all in 15 minutes. So to the extent that I don't get to something, I rely on my briefing. I want to start with service on the Secretary of State. The trial court said that I had the wrong form of service.
Well, the statute, Minnesota statute, the long-arm statute, 303.13, specifically excludes from the definition of foreign corporation insurance companies.
It does,
so,
but
under what circumstance, other than the Hunt case that you cite, could you even have thought that the Secretary of State was the right party to serve?
Well, the Hunt case does address that and allows suit against a foreign insurer in circumstances where it had nothing to do with the sale of insurance. Now, we do have something to do with the sale of insurance, but not in Minnesota. There is no statute that says the Commissioner of Commerce is the person to serve in a situation like this one, where you have an insurance company not authorized to sell in Minnesota and not selling in Minnesota.
But you had a document in your hand at the time that identified IDS as the insurance company, and that I think could have very easily been found out or discovered had you not waited to the last minute and been scrambling to get this case into suit.
I did not realize there was an issue about IDS.
Well, you did when you got their answer.
No, I did not. With all due respect, Your Honor, I did not.
Didn't you read the answer?
I did read the answer.
It says, I've got it right here. It says right in the answer.
It says in the answer that IDS issued the policy. I had pled, and this was technically inaccurate, that Ameriprise issued the policy. So it appears they're simply correcting that factual error, because the part of the pleading refers to paragraph 8, where I pled that Ameriprise issued the policy. There was nothing in the answer that said that IDS was underwriting the coverage at the time of suit. Nothing. Certainly had I...
Can you check into that? I mean, I'm going to be honest with you, Ms. Wallace. I'm really troubled by the fact that other than issuing a complaint and filing that, and answering a summary judgment motion, absolutely nothing has been done on this case to investigate it, to develop your claim, to answer defense discovery, or even to respond to the answer that says you got the wrong party here. I find that very, very troubling, quite frankly.
I can tell that, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And I know the trial court felt the same way. I don't think it's fair to characterize that I did nothing. I don't believe that.
I only meant it in the context of the court process. I'm sure you were communicating and things like that. The record supports that, but it seems like, well, I'll let you continue with your.
Well, no, I want to address it because it's clear that's why I lost below. It's absolutely clear. The entire focus of this case has become me, and it shouldn't be about me. I did address in the court below that it was embarrassing for me to have to admit I had made a number of mistakes, but I did not do anything that prejudiced these defendants. Nothing. They never claimed I have. The circumstances that caused me to do less than I would have liked to on this case are twofold, and they were explained.
You know, you don't have to get into that. All right. I've read the record.
Okay.
We all have, and I've seen your affidavit and your declaration, and I'm not making light of any of that, but we're looking at the legal issues here. It's really what we're looking at. So if I suggested I was making light of your circumstances, I absolutely wasn't.
I didn't think you were.
Yeah, and you can get back to your argument if you'd like then, because I think really the crux of your claim against Enterprise is whether or not you did obtain any sort of valid service through the Secretary of State. And because if you didn't, then it didn't seem like there's nothing to relate back to here. So
that's right.
So go ahead. I think I interrupted your argument on that.
That's okay. No one has pointed to any statute that would allow a Commissioner of Commerce service. There is none. We have 6821, which is what the trial court relied on, but it only allows Commerce Service if the insurance company is not authorized to sell in Minnesota and is doing so anyway. That's not Ameriprise.
So you're not disputing that Ameriprise is an insurance company and that you believe that, right?
Of course it's an insurance company.
Yeah, so.
But it's not doing business in Minnesota.
Well, there's no claim that they did business in Minnesota. The claim is that their clients who were from Wisconsin had an insurance policy that they received presumably there, and they just happened to be in Minnesota when they got into an accident. So what difference does that make? I don't see where there's any claim that Ameriprise was doing business in Minnesota or how, frankly, that's even relevant.
Well, 6821 requires it. And the trial court said 6821 is a statute I had to use. So that's why it's relevant. But it clearly doesn't apply because they don't do business in Minnesota. They don't claim they do. Certainly not unauthorized business.
Well, they claim they do in their briefing. I'm going to have that question for them as to where that's supported in the record. But
what appears to be the case is that IDS sells in both Minnesota and Wisconsin, and Ameriprise does not sell in Minnesota and is not authorized to. 6819 is for service on companies authorized to do business in Minnesota. And by becoming authorized, they appoint the Commissioner of Commerce, their agent. There is no other statute other than those two that anyone has seriously considered as a basis for suing the Commissioner of Commerce. I mean, it's not a common law thing. There must be a statutory basis, must be. And those are our only two options, and neither applies. And Hunt is the case that says 6821 and 30313 together, despite the fact 30313 says no insurance companies are supposed to cover everything. And so if 61A doesn't apply, it can be inferred, the Hunt Court says, that 30313 does. And 6821 does not apply. Therefore, we infer that 30313 does. And among the ways of service that it permits is service on the Secretary of State. If 303 1.3 does not apply, well, then they couldn't be sued in Minnesota at all.
Why couldn't you have filed it with the Commissioner of Commerce and then followed the other provisions that said send a copy of the complaint with the proof and everything that's required? It seems like there'd be no argument here had you did that.
Oh, I beg to differ, Your Honor. Had I done that, I would have had a motion for summary judgment pointing out that these two statutes don't cover the case. That's why I didn't do it. It's not that I didn't know about the statutes. I didn't read anything. I did. And it was clear to me that we had no statutory basis for serving the Commissioner of Commerce. It's not that I spent no time on trying to get this suit out properly. I wasn't scrambling around. I, in fact, got 2 days of respite from my training to get it done properly. And I think I did do it properly. And I know that's hard to believe because there's some things I haven't done properly. And that's embarrassing, and I don't normally practice law that way, but it's how it is. So, it is true that relation back turns totally on the question of service, except to the extent, and I want to make this clear, that the statute has not even begun to run on the underinsured motorist claim. It doesn't begin to run until the underlying case is resolved by trial or by settlement, which it's not been. So relation back really applies to the uninsured coverage. Now, Ameriprise has argued that it wouldn't relate back even if service was proper, but it's pretty clear. We cite at least 4 or 5 Minnesota Supreme Court cases that allow this kind of relation back after the statute has run. And they cite none. It's been the law for decades that in these kind of circumstances, changing a defendant by relation back is proper. Let me turn to the unsworn Connolly statement for a moment. The trial court allowed an unsworn statement taken by an insurance adjuster to come in as a business record. Rule 8036, business record exception, says that if something was prepared for litigation, and that's a quote, it doesn't come within the exception.
Do you have some case law that says a statement obtained under circumstances like this is a statement obtained in anticipation of litigation? I mean, it seems to me like any business in the business of leasing cars and insuring leased cars would be expected to at least do some cursory investigation of an accident involving a damage of one of those cars. How does that morph into a document prepared in anticipation of litigation?
Well, I have the Palmer case, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case, considering the same business record exception under federal law. And what we had there was an accident investigation report of a railway accident. And what the court said is, no, accident reports are for litigation. They're not for railroading. And that's the same here. Of course they want to investigate accidents, of course. But for litigation, how did they use the Connolly statement? The only way I know is in this litigation. They have suggested no other purpose for which they could have used it. None. And it has nothing to do with the car business. The idea of business records is they're a routine document, bills of lading, invoices, checks, accounting records, that kind of thing. Not the unsworn testimony of a person who, of course, is unavailable for cross-examination on top of everything else because you've just got the statement. And there, I could find no case in any jurisdiction allowing such a document under the business record exception. In fact, I mean, Palmer is the only case I could find that even talked about such an issue, even considered it. This is not something people commonly try to do, bring in the interview by the insurance adjuster. That's not a typical thing you see. and people haven't litigated it.
Did you make any attempt to locate this witness between the time you sued this out and when you filed your complaint to verify or not verify that information?
I think I found her on Facebook. Can't be positive that it's the same person, but the name is the same. But where she lives and how you get in touch with her, I can't tell you that either. As Enterprise says, it can't find her either. So it's not a common name, but all I could find was her presence on social media. In the 35 seconds I have left, I'll talk for just a second about theft or conversion. There, the Christensen case is what controls. There, the court said, the Supreme Court of Minnesota, that drunk driving or drag racing isn't enough to invoke the theft or conversion exception to the permissive user rule.
So if Ms. Connolly that day, instead of leaving the car in the driveway, had pulled up to a convenience store, walked in to buy something, leaving the keys in the car, and Mr. Carter had come out, jumped in her car, drove off, and this happened, would there have been a fact issue on permissive use?
No, because there's a case dead on point with the hypothetical you gave me, so no.
Well, there's no evidence in the record that suggests that he had some sort of permissive use to just grab the keys in the off the key hook in the kitchen, is there?
Well, the trial court thought it was a fact issue for trial, just that it was not material. So I suggest that there is. He lived in the house.
Thank you. Counsel for, is it Enterprise at this point, or EAN?
Yes, EAN and Enterprise.
Go ahead.
Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Daniel Staley. I'm the attorney for Enterprise Leasing Company of Minnesota and EAN Holdings. I think the situation we have here is an accident back in May of 2011. It was over 8 years ago. And since that time, plaintiff has really done nothing to investigate this claim or do anything to push it forward. I don't think you can sit on a claim for 6 years, serve on the last day before the statute of limitations, wait one more year to file, and then conduct no discovery during the 18 months that the case was in suit. We served discovery that was never answered. We filed the motion for summary judgment 6 months before it was heard by the court, and there was no effort for depositions or discovery to take place. The only evidence in this court, in this case, on the permissive use is the statement that was taken by Ms. Connolly. It wasn't a statement taken for litigation purposes.
Why not?
Because I think, like you said earlier, we have to do some sort of investigation. I mean, our car was involved in an accident. We have to call the person that we leased it to or rented it to and find out what happened. The case was not in litigation for over 6 years, so to say that it was prepared in anticipation of litigation when we didn't receive a summons and complaint for 6 years, I think is a little disingenuous. Enterprise was just trying to find out from the only person that they had any contact with what happened in this accident. And Ms. Connolly did swear, I don't have the language exactly in front of me now, but it's in my brief. She did say that she understands she's telling the truth and she's she affirmed everything she said in her statement. There is a bit of a new piece of evidence that I filed with the court just a few days ago. Mr. Carter has come to my attention, is deceased now. He would be the only person that could counter anything that would be in Ms. Connolly's statement. And these are things that happen 8 years after an accident. Witnesses die, and unfortunately, at this point, I don't think there's any additional evidence that she would be able to put forward to rebut anything in Ms. Connolly's statement. And I think plaintiff has some burden to offer proof to oppose a summary judgment motion. Basically, her only defense to our summary judgment motion is that the court relied on a hearsay statement. I think the district court has pretty wide discretion in determining what evidence is admissible and what should be considered. And I think given the circumstances here, this was the best evidence available, and I don't think there was any evidence that it was inaccurate or that had reliability problems. I think I cite the Bixler case, 376 Northwest 2nd, 209 Pinpoint 215, that the appellant here has the burden to show some material fact remains in dispute and to present some evidence to raise a factual question. And there was no evidence presented. The Sackett versus Storm case, 480 Northwest 2nd, 377, Pinpoint 379, a Court of Appeals decision from 1992 also indicates that mere speculation or of what might have been produced at trial isn't enough to overcome a summary judgment motion. The fact is that the summary judgment motion was pending for a good 6 months before it came on, and there was no steps taken by plaintiff to gather any type of evidence to discredit what was in Ms. Conley's statement. And Ms. Conley's statement was provided with initial disclosures within a couple of weeks of answering the complaint. Again, turning to the conversion, the Christensen case is different. That was a case where there was a man who had a work vehicle and he used the work vehicle after hours and he wasn't supposed to do that. What we have here is someone that Ms. Conley doesn't know took her vehicle to commit one felony and then committed another felony when he was caught. I think the restatement second of torts, section 223, comment B, indicates that a conversion is the intentional exercise of dominion or control over chattel. Here, Mr. Carter took the vehicle into his own uses by converting this vehicle, which subjected it to civil forfeiture under a number of statutes, one by committing a felony, by committing a controlled substance crime, and by fleeing from police officers. So regardless of whether Enterprise had a innocent user defense, the fact is the police could have easily forfeited this car and kept it, and they would have been subject to litigation to try to get it back. I think that shows a conversion of the vehicle. That's all the argument I have. I'll yield. If you have questions?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Staley.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Randall Gottschalk here on behalf of Respondent Ameriprise. Judge Floor, I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head. It sounds like you're really up to speed with regard to the service issues on this case, and that's what I'm going to talk about with the last few minutes that I have.
Well, Ms. Wallace says neither 68.19 or 68.21 applies by the clear and unambiguous language of the statute, and so therefore her only alternative was to pursue the service through the long-arm statute on the Secretary of State. Why is she wrong?
If you take a look at, and again, I'm going to rely on the briefing. I don't have all the issues in front of me that I'm going to talk about, but in the answer we identified that IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company was indeed the insurer. We provided a certificate of compliance with MnSTAT 68.06 showing that IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company is a foreign insurance company registered to do business in the state of Minnesota since December 29th of 1988. In the answer, not only do we identify that IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company is the proper defendant in here because they are the insurer, we also indicate that Ameriprise is not a legal entity. I mean, those facts put together should put anybody on notice. Wait a minute, I've served either a non-legal entity or I've served at least the wrong entity.
So your point is that the statute does apply because IDS is a company registered to do business in Minnesota and it does business in Minnesota.
Yeah, IDS is a foreign insurance company registered to sell policies in the state of Minnesota. They sued the case out of Minnesota. If you want to get jurisdiction in Minnesota over a foreign insurance company, that is 60A.19 authorizes the Commissioner of Commerce as the person to effect service of process, registered agent, and that 45.028 was the process upon which you serve the Commissioner of Commerce. And in a case involving IDS, I think it was a year or a couple years back, we were up here on this service issue with the Court of Appeals, and we actually went up to the Supreme Court on service issue with regard to 60A.19 and 45.028. And again, the Supreme Court unambiguously ruled those are the statutes that you look at with respect to a foreign insurance company that's authorized to write policies in the state of Minnesota. if you take a look at Section 303 and 5.25, they do specifically exclude insurance foreign insurance companies. And not only that, but they talk about service on foreign companies that do not have a registered agent in the state of Minnesota. And IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company does have a registered agent through the state of Minnesota by both the statute 60A.19, which authorizes the Commerce Department to accept service. But not only that, but and I think it came up in the oral argument in the summary judgment motion that CT Corp was a registered agent. So 303 and 5.25 don't apply. Those are the long-arm statutes when there is no registered agent in the state of Minnesota.
But there does seem to be some, I don't know how I would characterize it, but I mean, Ameriprise itself talks about IDS and itself kind of interchangeably. I mean, I can see where there might be confusion. I mean, I'm looking at a document here, it looks like an affidavit or some sort of testimony by Chad Albers that was an underwriting supervisor for IDS Property and Casualty, that on Ameriprise Auto and Home Insurance stationery, he says, I have confirmed our records. I mean, it seems like a reasonable reader might look at this and said, oh, our records, that's Ameriprise Auto and Home Insurance Company. Why shouldn't that matter?
Well, if you look through the briefing and through the ruling in the lower courts, they talk about all the numerous instances where IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company was identified as the insurer in this case well before the answer. The correspondences identified IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company as the insurer. The claims reps in their signature block said claims representative of IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. The contract of insurance says IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. The certificate of compliance that was filed, which is readily available online, identifies IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. And in fact, I think the district court used the word, when you take the totality of the circumstances together, IDS was, and this was in quotes, transparent about the entities Ameriprise, Auto and Home, and IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. And this is also the answer, identified IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company as the insurer and Ameriprise as not the insurer and not a legal entity.
So there is a legal entity, I assume, Ameriprise Home and Auto and Home Insurance. I mean,
my understanding is that is a trade name. Just like Metropolitan Property Casualty Insurance, MetLife Auto and Home, there's no such thing. Metropolitan Property Casualty Insurance is the legal entity, the insurer.
So that I'm clear, you know, in your briefing, either here or before the district court, where you say that Ameriprise is a foreign insurance company authorized to do business in Minnesota, is there support in the record for that?
In the briefing in the lower court, I used the term Ameriprise, and in the beginning of the brief, I said, look, because the caption says Ameriprise Auto and Home Insurance, I'm going to use the words Ameriprise, but the proper insurer and the proper defendant that should have been in this case is IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. That's where that comes in, Your Honor. With regard to Rule 15, excuse me, there's been no service on IDS Property Casualty. They are the insurer. There's no other conclusion that can be drawn. There has been no service on IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company, which, in your own words, Judge, there's nothing to relate back to. Appellant's counsel is trying to say, well, 1503 will allow us to relate back, and that's based on the service, the purported service on an entity, Ameriprise. But that service was done consistent with 5.25 and 3.03 by appellant, and that service is not sufficient to confer jurisdiction over IDS. Appellant's counsel is trying to use 1503 as a way to circumvent the service requirements of 60A.19 and 45.028 and instead say, well, I've got 15.03, so I don't need to comply with these statutes. I can pick whatever statute I want. I can pick whatever defendant I want, and we can relate back. But you can't relate back where there hasn't been proper service on IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. And it's not disputed there that they never even tried to serve IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. So there's nothing to relate back to. trying to do a 1503 on improper service is a way to circumvent the statute, Your Honor. I'm going to rely on the briefing with respect to the estoppel issue. I think it's quite thorough with respect to the case. So Ameriprise, and I'm using that because of the way the caption this case, but it is IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. Ameriprise requests that the decision of the lower court be affirmed.
Question. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wallace, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to talk about the service issue because it's very important. I'm looking at the letterhead, which is a piece of letterhead, Ameriprise, the corporate entity, and there is an Ameriprise that it's a corporate entity, and that is Ameriprise Insurance Company. I guess Ameriprise Auto and Home Insurance isn't a legal entity, but I only know it from counsel saying it. I have no proof. Big, bold letters, Ameriprise Auto and Home Insurance. Beneath it, Ameriprise Insurance Company, IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company, one address, 3500 Packerland Drive, De Pere, blah, blah. One website. Oh, yeah, they share a website. It looks like a merger. It looked like a merger to me, and banks and insurance companies merge all the time. And, yeah, after merger, often the name of the legacy company appears on letterhead or document. That's what it looked like to me.
Well, it might have been. I don't dispute that, but you also had information that IDS was the insurer. And had you done that check with the Commissioner of Commerce, that would have been readily apparent to you, but you didn't do that.
Well, I didn't have information except for the
declaration.
I had the deck sheet, yes, but the deck sheet was several years earlier. And the.
So aren't you just speculating that it wasn't accurate anymore? I mean, it seems to me a simple check would have made this a non-issue here today.
I don't recall, because it's been a while, whether I checked with the Department of Commerce. I know that later, much later, at the time of the summary judgment motion, it was on the website, and I assume that it was throughout. But that doesn't necessarily answer the question, because if there had been a merger, they wouldn't remove the insurance company from the Commissioner of Commerce records, at least I don't think they would. So I'm not sure I would have been safe relying on it. But no, I.
What evidence did you have that there was a merger other than your own speculation?
It looked like a merger. Everyone who called said, hi, Heather Geiser from Ameriprise. It looked like a merger. And the fact that you have one address implies to me that you've got one company. I never dreamt there were two, but there are two. There are two separate insurance companies that both call themselves Ameriprise. And I don't think wherever I'd looked I could have found that out, not at the time I was suing it out. That all came forward later at the time of the motion.
But at this point, there's no question about what all the legal status of the various companies is. What is there?
Only because they've made so many representations in court, they can't take them back. So there isn't. I mean, they wouldn't have said it in court all these times if it weren't true. But is it documented well? No. I have no idea.
Why does that matter, though? I mean, if in fact the legal situation is that IDS issued this policy, that it appears to me that there's no dispute about that at this point. Why does any of the confusion matter? I mean, is it some sort of defense that circumstances were confusing?
Well, yes, it is. But why does it matter? It's very simple. I had the deck sheet, so I know who issued the policy. But if it has merged, it's no longer a suable legal person.
Right, but they hadn't merged.
They hadn't, but
so that's a fact at this point. Is the fact that it was not clear that they had not merged, is that some sort of a defense? Or I'm not sure I'm not understanding what the argument is here, really.
Okay, well, if you look at Glenwood Hills State Hospital, if you look at, what's the name of that case? Right here. If you look at the cases that I've cited under relation back, the Ford case, similar kind of confusion over the identity of an insurance company. Letter says, send all correspondence to so-and-so insurance company. They sue so-and-so insurance company. It's the wrong one. Glenwood Hills State Hospital, same kind of name confusion we have here. The Carlson case sued Hennepin County Medical Center, didn't sue the separate legal entity that provided the doctors. So, yes, all of these cases say that confusion is part of relation back. It makes sense. And I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel, for both sides here. We appreciate your arguments and briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement and we'll issue a decision on the matter within 90 days.
Thank you.